Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonzo reporting. At least seven people, including a police officer, were killed in overnight separate incidents in Burundi's capital, as well as the surrounding area, according to police witnesses and an official Wednesday. One police officer was killed and four others wounded in clashes with gunmen overnight, according to a police spokesman. In a nearby neighborhood called Jabe, police say the body of a man was found, killed elsewhere, and his corpse dumped in the district. Four other dead bodies were found in two other neighborhoods, where a local official said the victims had been beheaded but may have been killed elsewhere. Meanwhile, residents of Mitimbuzi, which is outside the capital, said an unidentified man on a motorbike had thrown a grenade at a bar, killing two people and wounding three others. Cameroon says its troops have killed 100 Boko Haram militants and freed 900 captives that were held by the Nigeria-based militant group. The defense ministry says soldiers killed the militants as well as rescuing the hostages during an operation last week along the Cameroon-Nigeria border. However, there's been no independent confirmation of the claim. Meanwhile, officials suspect Boko Haram was behind twin suicide attacks that killed at least four people in far northern Cameroon late Tuesday. China's president arrived in South Africa Wednesday for a state visit and a two-day China-Africa forum expected to bring about billions of dollars in investment deals. South African officials are quick to point out that it's not President Xi Jinping's first state visit to South Africa. South Africa, after all, is China's biggest trading partner in Africa. The two nations are also members of the increasingly powerful economic bloc known as BRICS. VOA News. German Chancellor Angela Merkel says Afghans coming to Germany in pursuit of better economic circumstances will be sent back to Afghanistan. Speaking to reporters at a joint news conference with visiting Afghan President Ashraf Ghani in Berlin, Merkel said Germany would meet its humanitarian obligations for Afghans.
Wir haben noch einmal deutlich gemacht, der Innenminister hat es gesagt, dass wir...
That's the German leader, Angela Merkel. She says, where refugees come hoping for a better life, and I know this is a hope big for many, but there's no reason to get asylum status or residency status here, and that one needs to think about the 35 million Afghans at home, and the land has to develop with this. This is why we will, in such cases, have to send people back to Afghanistan. Germany is trying to reduce the number of asylum seekers from Afghanistan. Merkel and the Afghan president discussed ways in which Germany could help Afghanistan, as well as stem the flow of Afghan migrants to Germany. British lawmakers Wednesday are debating whether to approve Prime Minister David Cameron's request for the country to take part in airstrikes against the Islamic State group in Syria. Cameron appeared in Parliament to make his case Wednesday.
This is an ISIL first strategy. They are the threat. They are the ones we should be targeting. This is about our national security.
Again, that is the British Prime Minister David Cameron. The French Interior Minister says three mosques have been shut down in France since the Paris attacks as part of a crackdown on extremist activities.
Deux mosquées ont été fermées la semaine dernière à Lyon.
That's at French Interior Minister Bernard Cazeneuve. He spoke to reporters and said this was the first time mosques are being closed in France on grounds of radicalization. One of the mosques, which is 35 kilometers east of Paris, was targeted by raids early Wednesday, with police seizing a 9-millimeter revolver and a computer hard disk, as well as jihadist propaganda. Cazeneuve said the mosque also had a non-authorized Quranic school. One person was placed in custody following the raids. Two other mosques, also in the Paris region, were shut down last week amid a state emergency. Participants at the United Nations Climate Change Summit outside Paris are discussing resiliency Wednesday, exploring the impact of natural disasters on the world's most vulnerable populations. The participants at the UN conference know that the disasters affect not only economically, but also social and environmentally, affecting 217 million people each year. Wednesday sessions focus on oceans and other water resources. I'm Frances Alonzo in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up at this hour on Africa News Tonight.
China's president arrives in South Africa Wednesday for a state visit and a two-day China-Africa forum expected to bring about billions of dollars in investment deals.
That's VOA's Anita Powell reporting from Johannesburg. Details coming up.
Also, the human rights group Amnesty International says that some European countries are rejecting asylum applications from Eritrean refugees, and a general in charge of a Libyan government force in the eastern city of Benghazi was killed by a roadside bomb today.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Hungary's prime minister claims Germany has authored a secret pact to bring up to 500,000 Syrians from Turkey into the EU. Viktor Orban said today the agreement will be exposed soon. Mr. Orban has led political opposition to the migrant crisis and sealed Hungary's borders to migrants. The Greek migration minister says EU officials threatening to withhold visa-free privileges called charges not fair. Greece has been the frontline point of entry for the vast majority of refugees from the Middle East and Africa. Luxembourg Foreign Minister Jean Asselborn has conveyed a suspension warning on a visit to Athens this week. Some Central European officials, most prominently Slovak Prime Minister Robert Fico, have suggested excluding Greece from the EU's Schengen Agreement, granting free passage among EU states. Macedonian troops fired tear gas and stun grenades at Pakistani migrants trying to cross the border from Greece today.
The human rights group Amnesty International says some European countries are rejecting asylum applications from Eritrean refugees despite evidence that they face imprisonment and torture if they are forcibly returned to the country. Henry Ridgewell reports.
Eritreans are the third largest group of refugees arriving on Europe's shores after Syrians and Afghans. Stefan Simanowicz of Amnesty says the vast majority are young men fleeing oppressive national service.
Children from the ages of 17, 16 are forced into conscription. It was meant to last 18 months, but in reality can go on for indefinite periods. We spoke to people who had left after being in conscription in national service for 10, 15 years, others who'd had family members conscripted for over two decades.
A UN commission of inquiry earlier this year described Eritrea as one of the world's most oppressive regimes. The Eritrean government denied the accusations made in the report. Amnesty says the conscription amounts to forced labour, and anyone trying to evade or escape it is detained in appalling conditions.
If they are seen or caught, they can be shot and killed, they can be arrested, they can be tortured. Many of them are locked up in cells, underground cells, or in shipping containers for long periods as punishment for trying to avoid conscription.
Amnesty says the same fate would likely face Eritreans who had fled overseas but then forcibly returned. Despite this, some European countries, including Britain and Denmark, have begun rejecting the majority of Eritrean asylum applications. The British government changed its advice in March, claiming that Eritrea is safe for migrants to return to after leaving illegally. Simanowicz says they must change course.
The situation for Eritrean asylum seekers is a desperate one, and they must be given safe haven.
Speaking at last month's EU-Africa Migration Summit in Malta, French President François Hollande said the Eritrean regime must be confronted. He said the world needs to put maximum pressure on Eritrea because what is happening is extremely serious. Nobody is talking about it. It is a country that is becoming empty of its own population. Despite Britain and Denmark's approach, Eritrean refugees were among the first to be relocated from Germany to Spain under the European Union's new migrant plan. Each European country sets its own rules on asylum. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The United States is a top choice for refugees and others seeking a new life far from war, oppression, and other instability. Once they get to the U.S., refugee children face the challenge of learning English and attending an American school. In New York, a six-week program called the Refugee Youth Summer Academy helps children from dozens of countries to succeed in the vast public school system. It's a process documented in the new film, Refugee Kids, One Small School Takes on the World. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Sarah Rowbottom of the International Rescue Committee, which sponsors the academy, about the role education plays in helping refugee kids adjust and flourish.
Education is important not only to us, a value that Americans place a very high value on, but also something that refugees themselves place an incredibly high value on, and a real source of stability and something that's going to help them to regain that control over their future. Our students will be entering the public education system. However, that system is incredibly complicated. There are many layers, especially here in New York City. Our students may have had the benefit of a strong education, or they may have been educated in a refugee camp, or they may have been in unstable urban settings. Their educational experience of a head start on what that's going to be like. And that student is then going to raise their hand during the first week of school rather than waiting 3 months or 6 months to do. Experience is rarely similar to what they will experience when they enter school in the United States. So it's really essential that we give them a little bit of that. It welcomes them into the school system rather than dropping them into this very overwhelming, not always that friendly environment.
Tell me a little bit about the school itself now. What was the impetus for creating the school? How is a refugee as a term understood? Was this just anybody who arrived, people who've had to have suffered some kind of an oppression or violence to get here?
The Academy serves refugees, asylees, and other immigrant youth who have been affected by crisis. They're students that we are resettling ourselves, the International Rescue Committee. They're asylees who are being referred to us by other organizations, by schools, or actually by families through word of mouth. The school was created along with other youth programs in New York City in 1999 when there were refugees fleeing the former Yugoslavia. All of a sudden, there was a large population of young people who needed educational support. And so a variety of youth programs developed to support those youth. The demand for those services has never gone down. The impetus behind the school is really to provide that extra leg up and that head start to develop or maintain a positive attitude towards school. Many of our students come very highly motivated and with a really positive attitude towards school. But the reality is that English language learners in New York City graduate at, you know, maybe 35% to 40% compared to proficient students, which is closer to 65-70%. That's a big gap that we have to take into consideration and help them to access needed services, acclimate in a positive way, and have an experience of success during the summer so that they know what that success feels like. So then when it starts getting hard, they've already tasted success, and that's going to help to drive them further. Most of our students are very, very strong individuals who have a lot of resiliency, and we need to tap into that and teach them how to keep tapping into that so that they're going to be able to do that in not only in the year ahead of them, but all of the years that take them towards graduation.
Things are changing a little bit now. I mean, there's been a lot of talk now, obviously, about the Syrian refugees, and now since the Paris bombings, things are shifting again. Looking forward, what do you think is going to be the fate of these Syrian refugees sort of overall with respect to the school to make a dent?
We have resettled Syrians before. We'll continue to do so. Syrians, their lives looked a lot like our lives before it was disrupted by this political crisis. They had jobs. They had families. Their children attended school. But as children begin to arrive in New York City and their families are resettled, they're going to be very successful.
One of the things that I find so challenging and potentially very exhilarating is the similarity and the differences between the refugee children that come from some completely different kinds of places. But there are some commonalities, aren't there?
Absolutely. There are commonalities in the types of challenges that they have faced in coming to the United States. As you saw in the film, many of their families were separated for 5 years, 10 years, and they go through this process of having to get to know each other again and to reestablish the roles in the family. There are many challenges that are happening inside and outside of school that these students are going to share. There's the challenges for families who arrive intact. There are a lot of new, you know, power dynamics and things that are taking place as children acculturate typically faster than their parents, and they gain information, and they're starting to learn how to use that information to their advantage. The students, no matter where they come from, they will negotiate these similar types of challenges. And I think you can see in the film, they really bond over that. There are friendships that are made at the Summer Academy. They're a lifetime friendship.
That was Sarah Rowbottom of the International Rescue Committee. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York.
A general in charge of a Libyan government force in the eastern city of Benghazi was killed by a roadside bomb today. Colonel Ali Al-Toman was killed by a mine in a nearby Sidi Farag area. The Tobruk administration has been trying to drive Islamic State forces out of the region for several months. UN experts say the Islamic State has at least 3,000 followers fighting in key locations in Libya. Eight experts appointed by Secretary General Ban Ki-moon reported their findings to the UN Security Council yesterday. Libya has been divided into various political and tribal factions since the overthrow of longtime leader Muammar Gaddafi in 2011.
As many as six civilians died in twin suicide attacks in Waza, a city in northern Cameroon, last night. Security officials said a third bomber was shot and killed before she could detonate her explosives. Cameroon has been targeted by Boko Haram for more than a year. Government forces have joined four other Lake Chad Basin neighbors to combat the six-year reign of terror that has killed more than 20,000, mostly in northeastern Nigeria.
As the United Nations Climate Summit continues in Paris, among the issues on the table is the divide between rich and poor countries, with poorer, more vulnerable countries saying the wealthy should pay for adaptation to climate change. As VOA's Roseanne Scurble reports, huge investment projects are speeding ahead in Africa, where economic and agricultural development could be on a collision course with the environment.
The population in Africa is expected to nearly quadruple this century. This creates an unparalleled urgency to produce more food. At the same time, the continent is rapidly opening up to extensive mining, largely driven by foreign money.
Because of all that, there's these gigantic proposals for creating roads, highways, railroads, major projects that are going to penetrate into often remote interior regions of Africa.
William Lawrence is director of the Center for Tropical, Environmental, and Sustainability Science at James Cook University in Australia. He says these development corridors, which on average are between 1,000 and 4,000 kilometers long, would have an enormous impact on the continent.
They crisscross Africa. They would total more than 53,000 kilometers in length. And they just look like a giant spider web laid over the top of Africa.
But he says no overall plan or strategy exists to coordinate the many players, both foreign and domestic. In a study published in the journal Current Biology, Lawrence and his team assessed 33 major projects, either proposed or already underway. The assessment accounts for human population, agricultural potential, and environmental values, including biodiversity, endangered species, and critical habitat for wildlife and vegetation for storing carbon.
There was about six of the projects that looked like they were a pretty good idea, in the sense that they were going to yield a lot of agricultural benefits and not huge environmental costs. And then there was another six that I would take off the board immediately, that we're going to go slice into the heart of some of the most environmentally important areas of Africa, such as the Congo Basin and West African forests and some of the really critical equatorial and sub-equatorial forests of East Africa, places that are amazingly rich in wildlife and environmental resources.
The other projects fit somewhere in the middle. Lawrence advises caution moving forward. He says what may appear to be a great deal up front may turn out to yield unintended consequences. Take, for example, a large mining operation.
Limited numbers of people get really wealthy, and there is some more employment. But oftentimes what you find is there are still large segments of the population that are having to deal with everything suddenly, you know, food, rent, everything's becoming a lot more expensive, and they're not getting much benefit from it at all. So you're actually increasing the economic disparity. You get the pillar of the economy, which is mining, which swells and becomes huge, but the other pillars of the economy, all these other sectors, shrink down and become less and less important.
Lawrence calls for local and national studies that can direct governments to deploy mitigation measures and environmental safeguards that will assure a more positive future.
And if they're not in place, you can get runaway deforestation, you can get huge increases in poaching, you can get giant collapse of wildlife populations, you can get loss of tourism revenue.
Lawrence says the time to act is now, before the projects gain a momentum that will be impossible to slow. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. China's president arrived in South Africa today for a state visit and a two-day China-Africa forum expected to bring about billions of dollars in investment deals. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
South African officials are quick to point out that this is not President Xi Jinping's first state visit to South Africa, a fact that highlights the importance of the relationship between the two nations. Here's Clayson Monyela, a spokesman for South Africa's foreign ministry. He spoke to VOA News from Pretoria, South Africa's capital, where President Jacob Zuma is hosting the Chinese president.
The state visit by President Xi to South Africa is a very important visit. As you know, he's only been in office for less than 2 years, and already he's visiting South Africa for the second time on a state visit. That's quite unprecedented, and it speaks volumes about the strategic nature of the relationship between South Africa and China.
South Africa, after all, is China's biggest trade partner in Africa. The two nations are also members of the increasingly powerful economic bloc known as BRICS for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Xi comes to South Africa after a day-long visit to neighboring Zimbabwe, where he met with his counterpart, President Robert Mugabe. The two governments signed 10 agreements, including a $1 billion thermal power expansion project, according to Reuters. In South Africa, there is also a lot of money on the table, Monyela says.
There's a number of agreements and deals that are being concluded, billions and billions of dollars, which we believe will make a contribution towards growing the South African economy and assist us to deal with the triple challenges of poverty, unemployment, and eradicating inequality. So it's quite an important state visit.
But China's Commerce Ministry recently admitted that Chinese investments to Africa had fallen by 40% in the first half of this year, a move that some analysts attributed to China's slowing economy. Others, however, say it is more related to Beijing's changing approach to investments overseas. South Africa says they aren't seeing that, though, and that trade between the two countries rose more than twofold from 2009 to 2013. In the coming days, President Xi will meet with other African leaders in Johannesburg for a forum on Africa-China relations. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
As tobacco sales fall sharply in high-income countries, the industry has turned its attention to the developing world. In fact, a new study says people in poor countries are exposed to more intense and aggressive tobacco marketing than those in richer nations. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports.
The study compared the levels of tobacco marketing since 2005. That's when the World Health Organization Framework Convention on Tobacco Control took effect. Some 180 countries have signed it, including 14 of the 16 countries in the new study. Those that have signed it are required to adopt strict tobacco control measures, including marketing bans. The study, in the bulletin of the World Health Organization, warns of a looming threat to people's health in low-income countries if steps are not taken to rein in tobacco marketing. Professor Anna Gilmore is director of the Tobacco Control Research Group at the University of Bath in the UK and one of the authors.
We looked at levels of tobacco industry marketing in 462 communities across 16 countries at different levels of development.
She explains how tobacco marketing was measured.
First of all, we used a standardized 1 kilometer walk around all of these communities to observe the number of tobacco adverts and the number of stores selling tobacco and whether the stores sold single cigarettes. And single cigarettes are really important because under the Framework Convention, which is the world's first treaty on tobacco control, sale of single cigarettes is outlawed. The reason they're outlawed is actually a really key way of getting cigarettes to young people because young people often can't afford to buy a whole pack, so they prefer to buy in singles.
A second measurement was done by asking adults to report their exposure to tobacco marketing over the previous 6 months.
We measured 13 forms of marketing, so whether they'd seen posters or television ads or radio ads, print ads, ads in the cinema, as well as sponsorship, marketing on the internet, and so on.
Gilmore says tobacco marketing was much higher in developing countries.
So on our community walks, we observed 81 times more tobacco adverts in the low-income country communities than in the high-income countries. People also reported way higher exposure to cigarette adverts in the lower-income countries. So they were 46 times more likely to hear radio adverts, 11 times more likely to see poster adverts, and 9 times more likely to see television adverts. And overall, those living in low-income countries were almost 10 times more likely to report exposure to at least one form of what we call traditional marketing than people living in high-income countries.
Traditional marketing includes radio, TV, and newspapers. Past studies have shown that the more adolescents are exposed to these advertisements, the more likely they will smoke when they're adults.
The industry's documents that it was forced to release through litigation make it absolutely clear that it targets children with its marketing. So one of our key concerns is that with this level of marketing, what the tobacco industry is doing is still trying to recruit children into smoking.
She says implementing anti-tobacco laws is very difficult because of the tobacco industry's legal and financial resources. She rejects claims that tobacco taxes would help a developing nation's economy, citing a World Bank report to the contrary. Gilmore adds that bribery allegations have been leveled against some companies for allegedly trying to derail laws. The University of Bath professor says it's projected that tobacco will cause 8.4 million deaths by 2020, with 70% of those deaths in developing countries. A number of illnesses are linked to tobacco use, including cancer and cardiovascular disease. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Marty Curcius, thanks for choosing the Voice of America. Next, on Straight Talk Africa, after nearly 2 years of fighting the Ebola pandemic, Sierra Leone announced last month that the nation was Ebola-free. Guinean officials have declared that they will also soon be free of the virus. Join us Wednesday at 18:30 UTC when host Shaka Sali and his guests discuss the battle to completely end Ebola in West Africa. That's next time on VOA Africa.
When VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joburg.
Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.